Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. My guest is Chelsea Choi, who is an independent consultant and author of ChelseaChoi.com. Chelsea, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show. I found you because I was on the RailsConf website looking for potential guests because I figured, hey, if you give a talk at a conference, you probably are the kind of person who would be on a podcast too. And I really liked your talk. Because it was a topic that that is really important for developers to have, and I think a lot more developers could stand to be better at this. But before we dive into all that, do you want to give us a little bit of an intro of who you are?
Sure, yeah. So my name is Chelsea Choi, as you've heard. I am a software engineer. I work on a couple different projects. I work on a people-powered research platform that provides a mobile app that lets you help astronomers and earth scientists to go through their data and find interesting stuff. I work on a data processing pipeline for some NASA data. I work on an app that helps cancer survivors to follow their recovery protocols. Mostly I'm looking for projects that either advance basic scientific research or work towards saving the planet or improve access to resources for underserved communities. And I do that on mobile, on server, even a couple of machine learning models. It's been really fun, but I'd do any of it again, any stack, any day.
Based on the astronomy and NASA stuff, my natural next question is, have you been to space?
Have I been to space? You know, it depends on how you define space. So this is actually a really interesting question, and I'm pretty sure you don't want your podcast to be about it. But there are different definitions of space and what counts as space. I think probably according to all of the definitions, I have not been to space. But there are people for whom it's debatable whether or not they've been to space based on how high they went.
Okay, well, now that we've opened this can of worms, we can't not talk about it. So sure. You mean people who have been like up a certain height in the atmosphere, like what's technically space and what's not?
Yep, exactly. So generally low Earth orbit where the International Space Station is located is sort of everyone acknowledges that that is space. But then lower than that, there are questions about what exactly qualifies as space. So for example, the Blue Origin has sent craft up and people up to a certain height, as has Virgin Galactic, which is, let's say, higher than your average airliner would get, but not all the way to low Earth orbit. And the question is, how high up into Earth's atmosphere do you have to get before it counts as space? Is it the point at which the air density is like below a certain amount, or is it at some point relative to where the clouds are, relative to where Earth's like magnetic field is? And so it's an interesting question, although I don't think I've been to space under any of the definitions. For a while I thought I might have been, because for a while I thought some of the definitions included like where 737s and international flights tend to go, but now I think everyone sort of recognizes that as not space.
If you had the opportunity to go to space, would you do it?
If I had the opportunity to go to space, would I do it? That's a good question, because the thing about going to space is that it is a massively uncomfortable undertaking for the people who do. So just as an example, SpaceX recently launched Demo 2 to the International Space Station. Those astronauts had to sit in a very tiny capsule for about 19 hours before they got to the International Space Station. And once you're in a situation in microgravity, a lot of the things that we take for granted on Earth are not things that you have access to. So, for example, it's very hard to stay organized when Earth's gravity is not holding down all your stuff. And so you have to Velcro stuff to everything. You have to tie stuff to yourself. And then there's matters of, like, what do you get to eat? What do you get to drink? It's really, really hard to get good brewed coffee in space, actually. And
I find your resistance to going to space or your particular reasons interesting, because the first thing that comes to my mind is there's a very much non-zero chance that you're going to die. Your concern is that there's not very good coffee in space.
Well, see, the thing is that if I were to suddenly stop surviving, it is immediately not my problem, right? I am no longer experiencing anything. And so there's that, which is not to trivialize the matter. There is, of course, that matter. And I, you know, would prefer to stay alive for the time being.
Yeah, that's a very stoic way of looking at it.
Yeah, but I don't know if I could do it without my coffee. Although, fun fact, Don Pettit and Chell Lindgren, one of the astronauts, worked together to essentially design a device that did allow you to have brewed coffee in space. And it's super weird looking, but I'm told it works.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'll answer my question in case the listener is curious whether I would go to space. I don't think I would.
Yeah. Would you go to space? You don't think you would do it?
No.
Why?
Because I have kids, and so me dying would make them sad. And so I myself, you know, I look at it maybe kind of more similar to you. You're going to die sometime anyway. Might as well die doing something great. Or, I mean, you know, die doing something really, like, cool. Or, you know, maybe you don't die, and then that's great too. So it doesn't really matter exactly when you die, except sometimes there's people on Earth who would be sad if you died.
Yeah, that's true.
Not that I'm assuming there wouldn't be people who would be sad if you died.
Of course, but I don't have direct dependence in the way that you do. And so the risk evaluation is different for me than it is for you, because you have kind of like kids who depend on you, which I do not have at the time. So,
yeah. But if they made space travel safer, I would consider it. Okay. I guess that might be enough space talk for one programming podcast, but I'm glad we could, you know, this is not a new record for how fast we've gotten way off topic. But it probably ties for first. Okay, so Chelsea, your talk was on the topic of debugging. What gave you the idea to give a talk on this topic specifically?
Yeah, so debugging. So this is an interesting one for me, and this is kind of the reason that I decided to give that talk. I think it behooves a programmer to have essentially two modes of working, but generally we default to just one of them. So the first one is most programmers default. I call it progress mode. And this is a mode that allows us to move fast when we understand the code we're working on and we want to push forward with new functionality or like large refactors or something like that. And the thing about this mode is that it is the one that I see most demonstrated in programming tutorials. When people are showing you how to do something, they usually know what's going on. And this is also the mode that's most celebrated by like product owners and people who write listicles about what makes a 10x developer and all that stuff. So we tend to really valorize it. And it's also the one we teach, but it has a problem, which is that progress mode breaks down the moment we don't understand the code we're working on, because we end up in these vicious cycles where we try to change the thing that we think is causing a problem. And if it doesn't work, we try to change the thing we think is second most likely to be causing the problem. And if that doesn't work, we run out of ideas, and then we go back and we try the first thing again, and it still doesn't work. And now we're in this situation.
It's a little bit of a random trial and error.
Right, exactly. And it just takes... And it's at that point where we sort of find ourselves going in circles that I think we need the second mode of working, which is investigation mode. So in this mode, we're no longer focused on pushing changes. Instead, we're focused on narrowing down the problem space and testing our assumptions. So success in investigation mode is not like an incrementally broader feature set the way it is in progress mode. Instead, success when we're investigating is an incrementally tighter feedback loop, so we can experiment with the thing we don't understand in order to gain an understanding of it.
Can you say all that again, maybe a little slower? Not everything you said, but the part about the systematics, I didn't catch all that because there was a lot there.
Yeah, totally. So when we're in progress mode, we're focused on adding features or doing refactors, ideally quickly and ideally adding big things. And that's not what we're going for in investigation mode. Instead, in investigation mode, what we're looking for is a tighter feedback loop. So, for example, if something's wrong, and I know that it goes wrong somewhere between when I start up my app and when I navigate to a specific page, I want to narrow down that cycle to where in there it's happening. So maybe I can start the app and keep it running and narrow down the point where the bug is happening to a smaller and smaller like problem space until I've got a really small feedback. Say it takes me like 10 seconds to change something and see whether that fixed the problem. And if it doesn't, then I can go change that back, change another thing and see if that fixed the problem. And each of those loops takes me ideally under 10 seconds, but really the smaller you can get it, like if you're starting with a 25-minute cycle and you can get it down to 5 minutes, even that allows you a fivefold increase in the number of experiments that you can run relative to if you were just to leave everything the way that it is.
Okay, so it sounds to me, and tell me if this is the right idea or not, it sounds to me like this is the difference between random trial and error and systematic troubleshooting. With systematic troubleshooting, of course, being a much more efficient way to find out what's actually going wrong.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it's funny, right? Because we're reluctant to shift into investigation mode because it doesn't feel fast the way that progress mode does. But when we're dealing with unknowns, that precise investigation can help us resolve issues in less time and with a lot less effort, too, than this like brute force approach of progress mode where we're trying things and just hoping the next thing works.
Yeah, I think a lot of programmers, maybe I'm just projecting my own experience onto other people, but this definitely happens with me, is like I will be working and I'll be in some kind of state of flow, making progress, and then at some point things kind of go off the rails a little bit. And I go from steadily making progress to like something's not working anymore. And I don't want to lose my momentum. It feels right. Irresponsible to stop. And so I will like just continue. And like you said, like randomly poke around and try whatever seems most likely to be the problem. But then, oh, wait, that's not the problem. So I'll try this other thing. Oh, that's not the problem either. And I'm doing these things because I want to be fast. Mm-hmm. But counterintuitively, the way to be fast is to like mentally hit pause and say, hang on a second, let me articulate exactly what's happening here. Maybe even write down what the problem is and mm-hmm. start a systematic process of investigation. And then you'll get to the end of that much quicker than if you just stay in that first, as you call it, the progress mode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's something to be said for that. And I like the your comment about potentially writing it down, because one thing that that allows you to do is it allows you to choose when you want to be in each of the two modes and essentially deliberately switch, which can help with the efficiency. So for example, if you are moving forward and you're in progress mode and you run into something that isn't working the way that you're expecting it to work, sometimes if you can continue, if it's not a blocking issue, then you can kind of allow it to be wrong for a while, continue on what you were doing, but write it down. And then when you get to a good stopping point in progress mode, you can make a deliberate switch into investigation mode to determine what the issue was with that one thing that you found earlier. And sometimes I find that that helps with morale because it feels like we made a deliberate choice to figure this out as opposed to being forced to stop and get out of our flow state.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I definitely will do that because if if you just chase every single problem that pops up as you're coding, then you might not spend enough time on any one particular thing, and you might well, I don't know if you happen to if you know this book Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, but he talks about like he talks about the flow state, which is, you know, when you're working on something and you lose track of time because you're so engaged in what you're doing, versus what he calls psychic entropy. And what I take that to mean is like you're trying to think about multiple things at once, for example, and it just kind of scrambles your mind. And you like, if flow is juggling balls in your mind and doing it successfully, then psychic entropy is when you like drop all the balls on the floor and you get confused and you like stop. So my way of fighting off psychic entropy is to, just like you said, make a note of that thing that I want to fix in a minute rather than totally stopping.
It's I guess I don't know if this works with the analogy, but if I were to try to fit it in, I would say that if one ball were giving me particular trouble, I would determine whether I could just cast it aside and keep juggling the others and then come back to it.
Okay, so just to recap what we've covered so far, we talked about progress mode versus investigation mode. And now, when you're in investigation mode, how do you actually do that? How do you troubleshoot something, or however you want to phrase it, how do you debug something in this systematic way instead of just randomly trying stuff?
Yeah, there are a whole bunch of different tools that we can use, but I like to start with a big picture, which is kind of like the strategies that you can use for debugging. So the first one I call the standard strategy, and this is what we're doing when we try the thing that we think is most likely to be causing the bug, and if that doesn't work, try the thing that we think is second most likely to be causing the bug, and then if that doesn't work, try the third thing, and so on and so forth. That strategy is useful in those situations where we generally have an understanding of our code, and we know it's probably like one of these two or three things. And so, in that situation, it can be a useful strategy. But again, it breaks down when we understand the behavior of our code less and less because we end up in this situation where we're out of ideas and trying things over again. So, in those cases, I generally switch into one of two other strategies. So, the first one I kind of refer to as the binary search strategy, which is that I know this starting point before the bug surfaces, and I know this finishing point that's always sometime after the bug surfaces. So I'll try to find a point like halfway between those two and see if I can at that middle point go ahead and start examining some of my assumptions about what's going on to determine whether the circumstances of the bug are already in place at that point or not. And if they
Okay,
are
I'm
already
sorry.
in
Let
place.
me interrupt a second. Can we say like what a binary search is?
Sure. So in a binary search, you have two points, A and B, let's say, that you want to get to. And I don't know. How would I describe this? So let me start with the binary search tree as an example. So the binary search tree is a data structure, right? And it let's say that you were holding numbers inside of this tree. The first number, the base node, is sort of like exactly in the middle. And all of the numbers to the right of it are bigger than it is, and all of the numbers to the left of it are smaller than it is. And because you understand the order there, you always know if you need a bigger number than the one you're at right now, you need to go to the right. And if you're looking for a smaller number than the one you're at right now, you need to go to the left. And you make that decision at each node of the tree. Similarly, in binary search, you know, like if I want to get further in the code, if I want to be earlier in the code execution path, I need to move back. Whereas if I want to be further along in the code execution path, I need to move forward. And so if I start in the middle, determine whether the circumstances for the bug have happened yet or not, then I can say if they've already happened, I need to go back and determine what's happening ahead of now. If the circumstances that created the bug have not occurred yet, then I need to move forward and do the same investigation. And I can keep doing that until I have found the bug. And the thing that makes this strategy efficient is that every time you do that investigation, you cut in half the amount of the like process from start to finish that you need to investigate. Because if I start halfway in the middle, then I determine if the bug is happening in the first half or the last half of this kind of sequence that I have. And then I take the first half and I cut that in half. And I determine if it's happening in the first half or the second half of that. And then I cut that in half. And so I've done it three times and I've already narrowed down the problem space by eight. And I'm dealing with 1/8 the amount of like code execution that I was at the very beginning of investigating the bug.
Yeah, it almost seems like magic how efficient a binary search can be. Because like, let's see, to get down to that, to narrow it down to just 1/8 of the code, let's see. In the first step, it takes one step to narrow it down to half, two to get it down to a fourth, and three steps to get it down to it. So in only three steps, you've eliminated 7/8 of the code. And you know that that 7/8, you don't even need to bother looking in that area. It's crazy that it works like that. It's crazy that it works so well, but it does.
It is really interesting. I like the strategy also of, so with Git commits, if you have incremental Git commits, you can also use a binary search strategy with Git commits to determine when in a code base's history something has happened. And every time I have to look up the documentation for exactly how to do it, but say you have 18 commits and you say that you want to search for something that's happening at one of these 18 commits, it'll automatically put you at 9. And then you tell it whether you want to go right or left. And if you want to go left, it'll automatically put you at like 4 or 5. And then you keep telling it like that until you found the commit where your issue was introduced.
Yeah, I love that feature. And at the risk of taking us on a huge digression, I'll try not to make it a huge digression. But for if you have like a, let's say you know at one point in time your this feature was working, and then you discover that the feature is not working, but you don't know when it stopped working. It's like, okay, it is June. I know that back in March this feature was working, so I will check out a commit back in March, verify, of course, that that feature is in fact working at that point in time. Then I can say git bisect good. And then I'll go to today's commit, verify that the feature is not working, and say git bisect bad. And then it'll take you automatically to halfway between today's date in June and that date back in March. And you test it again and say git bisect good or git bisect bad. And it's crazy. It never takes all that many times to get to it because of that, like, I don't know the math thing, but it's like the opposite. It's like the inverse of exponential.
Asymptotic?
Yeah, something, maybe. I don't know. But like, it's back to like that magical feeling of it again. Like, you can get through a huge number of commits in a really short amount of time. So dear listener, if you've never used git bisect, that's a really great feature for narrowing down bugs. Okay. Where were we? You were talking about, you were making
the binary search strategy. Yeah. So the other strategy, and this one might be the place to start if the binary search strategy sounds like a lot. The other strategy that I'll use, and this one's really useful if like you have asynchronous code and it's just really difficult to define what halfway through the execution is, or if you're just like not in a place where you are ready to do the bisecting thing, you can just go through incrementally essentially and say, all right, the code has begun executing. Let me test a bunch of assumptions right after the code begins executing. Everything seems fine. So now I'm going to go a little further down the line. And once again, I'm going to check to make sure all of my assumptions are correct. And then keep going along the line between when the code begins executing and when the code finishes executing, or like whenever the bug happens, to figure out exactly when things are going wrong. Basically by starting at the beginning and just taking very small steps toward the end.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so those are sort of my two overarching strategies for figuring out where a bug might be located. And then Like in terms of figuring, in terms of doing the actual investigation step, there are all kinds of tools we can use. There's, you know, automated tests are sort of considered the gold standard here. And so the thing about tests is I don't attach like morality to tests the way that I think we tend to in programming rhetoric. But I think that tests do, they allow us to run a series of small feedback loops simultaneously, which is really, really useful because then we can check a bunch of paths through our code really quickly.
Wait, sorry. What do you mean by attaching morality to tests? I'm not sure that I'm familiar with this.
Yeah, totally. Sure. There's sort of this like normative judgment made of like, oh, if you have tests, then that's good. And if you don't have tests, then that's bad. And by extension, if you write tests, then you're good. And if you don't write tests, then you're bad. And it's like, well, it's a little more complicated than that because sometimes like the thing we're trying to achieve with tests is a tight feedback loop, right? And they happen to be good at that in many circumstances. But that doesn't mean that the test itself is the goal. The tight feedback loop is the goal. The test is one way to achieve that that is often effective, but it's not the only way to get a tight feedback loop, and it's not always even the best way to get a tight feedback loop. And so I tend to be very careful not to like judge a code base on what's tested and what's not tested because I don't necessarily know what verification process is the most effective for this code base.
Hmm. Interesting. I would agree with at least some of that. Maybe I agree with all of it. I would contend that if there's a code base where the developers have just made the choice that tests are a waste of time and so they didn't write any tests, I'd say that that is objectively worse than having at least some tests.
I would agree that in the vast majority of cases, having some tests is useful. I think that the determining whether a test is going to be the right choice or not is something that I'm looking at on like an individual feature level or even like an individual component level rather than the app as a whole. Because on most software projects that I have seen, automated testing would have been useful on some part of it at the very least.
Yeah, same here. I don't think it's useful to write a test for every single thing, and I take it on a case-by-case basis. I don't know that I could articulate exactly what my judgment criteria are for that. I end up, last time I checked my test coverage, it was at about 97%. So that means, of course, I test most things, but not absolutely everything. And I think if somebody treats it as a religious tenet that they should have 100% test coverage, I think that is maybe illogical.
I think sometimes folks end up spending more time getting to 100% test coverage than was necessarily worth, like the additional security wasn't really worth the other 3%, and or the tests aren't really like verifying anything. They're just running the code to get to the coverage number.
Yeah, that doesn't seem helpful.
Yeah. But like in addition to tests, there's all these other ways to verify stuff, right? The first one that we learn as programmers is usually like a manual run through type of thing. Developers start doing that almost as soon as they start to write code. They write some code, then they execute it and they see what happens. And we can continue to do that when we want to check things out. So that's definitely not to be discounted. Then we can do, so we could set breakpoints. That's another way that we can like check on something, open a console at a breakpoint, look at variables and scope. We can use print statements, which, you know, a print statement is something that's really useful. Like if a breakpoint's not working, or if the code is multi-threaded, or it's like asynchronous so that we don't know whether the buggy code is going to run before or after the next breakpoint or something like that, a print statement can come in really handy. Or logging, we can use logging in exactly the same way. So we have, you know, automated tests are a tool for getting what we want, and they're often an effective tool. We also have all these other tools that I think it's valuable for us to keep in mind.
Yeah, and I want to bring up something you mentioned in your talk, which was that there's all these different kinds of tests. Automated tests are one kind of test, but also these other things are tests too, but in a different sense. Like, they're not tests as part of the software development process. They're not like tests that get run as part of, I should say it this way instead, they're not tests that are part of the release process. They're tests that are part of your investigation process. So like,
right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, they're tests. I think you said this too in your talk. They're tests more like in the scientific experiment sense. You're doing it to gain some knowledge.
Right, exactly. They're not automated, but they still serve a purpose of verification.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, and then, so those are sort of like the tools that I'll use for the most part in debugging and that kind of thing. And I think at that point, the question becomes like, what are we debugging here? You know, what are we looking at the variables and what their values are and those kinds of things. And that's something that I think it does take intuition to build, to know what to check on. I know that some of the most insidious bugs that I have run into in my career have been things that, like, we all just assumed were working, and so we didn't check them. It wasn't even that they disguised themselves as working when they weren't. It was just we didn't even, like, look at it. You know what I mean? And so I think it's even true that, like, in the case, so a lot of times it'll have to do with renaming something. So, for example, there's like a typo in some name is sometimes what happens. And sometimes we figure those out quickly, and sometimes we don't figure those out quickly. And so those are the kinds of things where it behooves us to really stop and check some of that stuff. Another one that I see a lot of times is a scoping issue. We assume that the scope of a particular variable was one thing, but the scope of that variable was actually a different thing. And it ended up persisting a value when we wanted it to let go of that value, or letting go of a value when we wanted it to persist. And something ended up being null. We didn't want it to be null. I see that happen a lot. And it ends up being that, like, the more I see this pattern, the more I'm convinced that it's not just that insidious bugs come from inaccurate assumptions. It's deeper than that. It's like that insidiousness as a characteristic of bugs comes from inaccurate assumptions. And the way that they stay in there is by hiding in the stuff that we're not checking, you know? Like, we're looking in the code, but the problem is rooted in our understanding of what the code's supposed to be doing. And it just takes an awfully long time to find something when we're like looking in the wrong place, you know?
Yeah, okay. So I've come to a realization over the last couple years, and tell me if this is the same thing you're talking about or something different, or maybe it's even something that overlaps. I've kind of done a little mental postmortem of several bugs that have been found in production in the application that I'm currently working on. And in pretty much every case, it's not that the code is behaving in a way that's other than what I intended. It's that there's something there that didn't even occur to me to check.
Right.
It's like, I wish I could think of an example off the top of my head. It's been a little bit since something like this has happened, but it's like, a user uses the feature in a way that I never anticipated. And
Right.
when they take that path through it results in behavior that doesn't make sense. And it's not that I coded something and I had like a greater than and less than sign flipped. And so it's not something like that. Everything was working exactly as I intended. I just didn't think to test that case.
Totally. So I have a really funny story about this. So I worked on a mobile app where we, like I mentioned, it's for people-powered research, and we have this particular project where we ask folks to identify constellations in paintings. The project is called Mapping Historic Skies, and we wanted to make that project available for museum goers at the Adler Planetarium to participate in on the museum floor. So I made all these changes to the application so that it would look good and do the right things in an exhibit setting. And then we installed it on two iPads. And we installed the iPads in the exhibit. One of them was at about 5 feet high for adults to use. And one of them we installed at about like 2.5 feet high for children to use. And so it got on the floor and the exhibit opened and we started looking at the crash reports. And there was one crash in particular that kept happening, and it had to do with our API call not coming back before something else happened. And I was trying to figure it out, looking through the code, and I could not for the life of me figure out what was going on. But then I looked at the pattern in where the crash was occurring. Overwhelmingly, the app that was crashing was the one installed at 2.5 feet high. And so I went upstairs and kind of watched some people use it and thought about, you know, what is like an 8-year-old going to do that it's not going to occur to an adult to do? And it turned out that the problem was that they were like just mashing the submit button over and over and over in rapid succession. And that was what was doing it. And that's not something that adults were doing because they've used apps and they know, hit the button, wait, and then the thing's going to come back. Whereas kids, if they've used touchscreens before, it's mostly to play games where you like touch things over and over. And that ended up being the problem. And we fixed it. I think I disabled the button until the call came back so you could hit it as many times as you wanted and it wouldn't like change the flow or keep firing off calls to the API. But
that's great.
Yeah.
I think you raise a really important point, which is the value of actually watching people use the thing you built. Because I've always said to people that non-tech savvy users, and maybe not even just non-tech savvy users, but users of your software will use, they'll abuse your software in ways that you find surprising and appalling and that you never would have anticipated. And
right.
So you really have to just watch people because, like, it's crazy. Like, you watch people do stuff and you're like, what? You're doing this like that? That's
right.
Yeah. And you never could guess. You just have to watch.
Yeah. It's really funny sometimes. You'll see, like, in user testing people, I constantly learn something in user testing because folks have all these different ideas about how they want to figure out how they want to navigate to the thing that they need and that kind of stuff. And it's always eye-opening for me as the engineer because I am mostly focused on the happy path, right? I'm mostly focused on the way that somebody who knows how this software works is going to use it. And I learned so many things from user testing about discoverability, about making this app usable to folks who have not been heavily briefed by a product manager about how it's supposed to work. They should be able to open it and kind of figure it out in most cases.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a whole, I used to not have that skill. And I would get really like frustrated when I would build things that turned out to have a low level of usability. And then I learned about like usability testing, which kind of overlaps with these things we've been talking about. But there's a lot to it. And again, watching people actually use the thing is a super important part of it.
There is. It's really amazing. And I just have to admire designers so much for the work that they do in that area because I'll see, a design sometimes and I wonder, why did we put that there? How do we do this here? And they often have these insights that never would have occurred to me about all of the ways that people are going to misinterpret it. And they essentially have to, every time they design a screen, they have to make judgment calls about, considering that no matter what we do, people are going to misinterpret this. How do we reduce the misinterpretations as much as possible? And then after that, when those misinterpretations do occur, how do we kind of get people back onto the right path? Or how do we put up some guardrails so that people don't end up in a spot with the app that they're not supposed to be?
Yeah. Yeah. And dear listener, if you're hearing us talk about these kinds of things and you want to build some of these skills yourself, a couple of books that really helped me are the classic Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug. And then this other book that I've never heard anybody else talk about, which is Criminal, because it's one of the absolute best books I've ever read on programming, period. It's called User Interface Design by Soren Lausen. That book, like, changed the... it changed the trajectory of my career, no exaggeration. Okay, so once again, I derailed us completely. Do you remember where we were before we went on this side trail?
This time, I do not. I don't remember what we were talking about.
So we were talking about the binary search, and we were talking about the different kinds of tests and an automated test versus like a test for a scientific experiment. Here's something we could maybe touch on, and I don't remember if this was in your talk or not. I watched most of your talk, but the idea of like not fooling yourself into thinking you know things that you don't really know. And I suspect this is something you've thought about because it's part of that knowledge gathering process. You perform a test and you gain a piece of knowledge. And obviously it's important to like make the distinction between knowledge and assumptions and conjecture.
Yeah, it totally is. I think that as we build our debugging skills, one of the things we really need to be able to do to debug effectively is to identify kind of what is the truth and what is our perspective. So I can't even tell you like how many things, particularly in like the beginning of my programming career, I was sure, like beyond a shadow of a doubt, that such and such was true, and it ended up not being true. And I think that as my confidence as a programmer has grown, my confidence in my willingness to second guess my own assumptions about what's happening has also grown. And on a number of occasions, it's managed to save me a ton of time because barging forward with an assumption that ended up being incorrect would have cost a whole lot. And I've also been on the other side of that where, you know, like we've talked about, making an assumption and sticking with it kind of cost a bunch of time when it ended up not being correct in the end.
Yeah. I have a little story about this, and I'll tell this at the risk of embarrassing myself because I feel really dumb about it, but I want to share it because it's an example of even a towering genius like me can be wrong once in a while. So we had this situation. I don't know how much background I need to give on the app, but we have the ability to accept payments. And on one occasion, we had a double payment, and we're taking payments from patients at a medical clinic. So we had an actual screenshot of the patient's bank account where we saw that there were two charges for the same amount on the same day. So we knew that the charges actually did happen. And I looked at the logs and I looked at the database, and I could see, well, long story short, I saw something that led me to. Oh, here's another thing. With this same patient, after the first charge happened, I had been asked to manually generate a new receipt for that payment because this is a new area of the system and we don't yet have the ability to generate receipts on demand. That needs to be done manually. So I had gone in there really shortly after the charge was created. And I generated a receipt. And so I reviewed the events in my mind and I said, oh, a payment happened. And then I went in there and messed with stuff and a duplicate charge was created. And I said, well, the most likely thing is that it was me. I created this duplicate charge. And so I went with that assumption, or I went with that belief. I didn't consider it an assumption, I considered it knowledge.
Right, the truth.
Yeah, but turns out I was wrong. It was not the truth. It turns out I looked at some things later and I discovered that what evidently happened was that the person who accepted the payment clicked the create charge button or whatever it is, and then the charge appeared to fail. And since it appeared to fail, the person tried the same charge again, and the second time it appeared to work, and in fact it did work, but actually it worked both times. what clued me into this was that it seems a little fishy and not right that you should be able to incur a charge just by like messing around with some stuff in the Rails console, despite the fact that we don't save credit card information. That seems that like doesn't add up. So that led me to go further into my investigation. But I was wrong for long enough at the beginning that it like I reported to other people, like, here's what I believe happened. And then I had to go back afterward and say, no, I was wrong. That's not what actually happened. This other thing happened instead. So the danger of fooling yourself into thinking you know something you don't actually know is completely real.
A tough one, and it ends up like costing us so much time. Another one that happens to me a lot, and I have to be careful about this one. Sometimes, particularly earlier in my career, people would tell me how it is with this confidence in their voice, and I would just like believe them. And I felt that it would be, disrespectful to go and question that assumption. But then, if that assumption turned out to be inaccurate, I was now sinking 4, 8, 12, 16, 24 hours of work time before I figured out that that was the case. And so I've gotten better about determining what to, like, I guess the term for this would be that I do a lot more trust but verify now when I'm collaborating with people. And which isn't necessarily to say that like folks were wrong or meant to lie or any of that kind of thing. It's just that as software changes, it can be that something was accurate once upon a time and now it's not accurate. And that's usually the way that I end up framing that kind of thing when I'm bringing it up to other people, is that like this assumption made sense when X was true, but now maybe Y is true, or maybe something has changed, or the there's an update or something, and now maybe it makes more sense for us to do it this way.
Yeah, it's definitely true that human beings are fallible and even really smart people can be wrong a surprising percentage of the time.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're all, I think being wrong is something that happens to all of us constantly. And I think that we sometimes do ourselves a disservice as we gain experience or what have you, because we can, if we are not careful to remember it, we can lose sight of the degree to which we might be incorrect about things. Or we could be, the longer we've been in this career, the more time we have, which means we might be drawing from a prior experience that happened 8 years ago, but everything worked completely differently 8 years ago, and the lessons that we learned 8 years ago are not applicable to the current situation. So I
Yeah,
see
that's
that happen
definitely.
sometimes.
So as I get older and gain experience, I get a little more cynical in certain ways, which I think is healthy because if you place too much trust in too many things from a truth standpoint, you'll end up believing things that aren't true. And so it's often a good idea to say, okay, you said that thing. You're generally right about things, and I generally trust you, and you're smart. But let me check because I don't trust anything that much, not even myself. The only way to know what's actually true is to go to the source.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I love source code for that too. When I need to figure out exactly how something works, one of the big advantages I think of open source software, at least for me, is that I can go and look directly at the code that I'm trying to run and determine what's happening in there under the hood. And that is such a powerful and underutilized resource, I think, for learning about software engineering in general and learning about the problem that we are trying to solve specifically. A lot of times that has been the answer, sometimes the only place with an accurate answer, and it's just sitting there and it's available for free on, GitHub or whatever.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because, for example, documentation can be wrong, but the code can't really be wrong. Even the code in documentation can be wrong because you could be looking at a version that's different from the version that your application is actually running, And so the only real source of truth is the code that your application is running. And do you mean like actually going in and looking at the source code of like, if you have a gem installed, like go and look at the source code for that gem and figure out what it's doing based on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I've done it with gems. I've done it with a couple Python packages. I've done it even with Swift, the Swift programming language. So yeah, it's just such a useful tool, I think, to be able to, and to not be scared to investigate the code that we're running.
Yeah. I've only done that a few times, partly because it didn't occur to me for a long time that that was even something I could or should do. But on the occasions when I did it, it was great because it was the way to like really get right in there and figure out what's really happening. You mentioned something else, which I thought was a good point, which is like the educational value of looking at the code of open source libraries. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Oh, just like the idea of looking at the code of open source projects as a way of learning about coding styles and stuff like that. I think that's what you're saying. I'm not sure though.
Yeah. So I guess that's something that I started doing a few years ago, and I found that I had built the skill first, not on open source projects, but actually on projects that I was working on in teams. And so there were 7 people who had built a mobile application or something, and then I rolled onto that project and was expected to continue maintaining it. That was largely what I did, and is still what I do. And so it's really important for me to be able to investigate how this code was written, to be able to make educated guesses as to why it was written this way, under what circumstances would these be the right decisions for software engineers to make, what changes in these circumstances would necessitate a change in this code, or even like how it's organized, being able to navigate between different parts of the code. So I see a method, I don't know what it does, so I navigate to its definition and I determine what's going on there. Or I see that some libraries are being pulled in and I don't know what they do, so I go and look at the documentation of those libraries and I determine what it is they're doing. Or I have questions about how this was implemented that I don't have the answers to, and so, or I can't guess the answers to, and so I go confer with other engineers to determine why they think it might have been done this way, or how they would have done it if they were faced with the same circumstances. And that was a little easier, I think, on team projects than open source projects, because with a team project, I can go over to a person on the team and say, hey, I noticed in this commit you did XYZ. Can you explain to me what your reasoning was so that I understand how to maintain this code? And with open source, sometimes it has to be more of a guessing process because open source maintainers are busy. But even going through the thought exercise of imagining the circumstances under which it would make sense to build it this way has helped me when I end up in a similar set of circumstances while I'm building software. And I have a library in memory of the solutions that I've seen to solve problems like these.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, reading other people's code is not something that I do enough of. I need to do that more. But it makes total sense. Like, you wouldn't expect to become a great novelist without reading a certain amount of the world's literature and kind of loading their devices into your head so that you can emulate them and that kind of thing. So that seems like a really good technique. We're getting close to time, so I have a couple very last questions for you. Let's see, your talk is called Debugging Techniques for Uncertain Times by Chelsea Troy. I'll put that in the show notes. That was a RailsConf 2020 talk. Are you doing any, obviously people aren't doing in-person conference talks because of the whole coronavirus thing right now, but are you doing any kind of talks for online conferences or anything like that in the near future?
Yeah. So I'm a supporting speaker for Juneteenth Conf, which is happening this weekend on Friday and Saturday. And I highly recommend taking a look. I believe registration is free, but they have two tracks of really amazing talks that are happening, and they're going to have even more talks available on their channel online and linked from their website. So mine is going to be one of those. And on that occasion, I'm going to be talking about, which one is that? That's the Technology and Psychology of Refactoring is that talk. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice. And then very last question for you, where can people go to find you online?
Well, I am Hey Chelsea Troy everywhere. Chelsea spelled like the neighborhood in New York, Troy like Helen of Troy. And then I do a whole lot of writing about code and tech and the tech industry at chelseatroy.com, spelled the same way.
All right, and I'll put all that stuff in the show notes. Chelsea, this has been great. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.